Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
President Biden holds a press conference yesterday, and he informs every pro-gun voter that he has decided to bypass Congress. Take executive action to advance gun control, but I'm not sure that what he is attempting to do is wholly achievable. Here to talk to us about it is Amy Swearer, a legal fellow at the Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies of the Heritage Foundation. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, Amy, we have this big press conference yesterday, and the president outlines a couple of things there. I said just a second ago, I'm not sure that a lot of what he's talking about is actually what he's saying and what he hopes to have in regulations. I'm not sure that these are wholly achievable. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think there's two big barriers to what he's trying to do here. The first is legal. So right now we don't, of course, have the rules that he has told the Department of Justice to put out. But if they're anything like some of the other things that that the Department of Justice has tried to do informally, there's going to be some very serious legal issues because, again, it's not up to the executive branch to rewrite and redefine things that are already defined in federal law. That's Congress's job. So there are some legal problems depending on what they try to do. And the second is a practical problem. If President Biden is actually interested in not just making political noise, but in reducing gun violence in this country, then what he's actually trying to do isn't going to solve the problem. So he's going after things like arm braces for pistols that really aren't major underlying causes of gun crime in any way, shape, or form. And also, he's not trying to ban them as much as putting them under the National Firearms Act, so you can still get them. It's just going to be more time-consuming and cost you $200, and the government's going to get more money out of you. So it's not really doing anything that's going to save lives. It's just going to get the government more money.
In other words, for that arm brace that he's talking about, you're going to be able to get it. You're going to just have to jump some hurdles to do it. And most importantly, you're going to pay the government some money.
Right. And it's far more likely that what's going to happen is not that criminals are going to cease using the ones they already have or find other ways of continuing to commit crimes without arm braces. What's more likely is that you're going to have law-abiding citizens who have never, you know, who for years have owned these braces responsibly, who are either going to neglect to pay the tax or are not going to be able to pay the tax. And all of a sudden, overnight, they're going to be felons, even though nothing has changed except they couldn't pay the tax.
Yeah. And it should be noted for the benefit of the listening audience, because I think, you know, the dialogue has this arm brace thing kind of in this like never land out there, this mystery about it. This is an apparatus that was actually approved by the ATF, right?
Right. So the ATF for a long time has said, so right now, if you have a short, what's known as a short-barreled rifle, those are highly regulated under the National Firearms Act. But the ATF for a long time has said these types of braces that don't, so basically they're designed to attach to your inner arm and sort of stabilize whatever sort of handgun you're using, those are not and do not make the gun into a short-barreled rifle. And so they're kind of trying to do what they did with buntstocks, which was to say, well, yeah, for a long time we said this wasn't, you know, it didn't do X, Y, and Z, but now we're changing our minds. And all of you who have had it under the auspices of it being legal, well, sorry to tell you, we've changed the rules on you and it's no longer legal.
Right. So there were a number of things that the president misstated yesterday. It was kind of almost comical at one point. Any person that knows just a little bit about guns recognize, and you know, the brace stocks was one where he said that these items are totally concealable. Now, unless you're putting it in elongated backpack or you're walking around with a trench coat in the month of June or July or something like that, I mean, you've taken an otherwise concealable firearm apparatus, a pistol, and you've elongated it to the point that it is less concealable, right?
Right, right. And especially now when you get into differences, I mean, even just in the history of, you know, at the time when these short-barreled rifles were first regulated under the National Firearms Act, there was a sense in which they weren't commonly used by law-abiding citizens. It was what a lot of gangsters used. But now when you really get into it, these are predominantly used by these arm braces, these pistol braces, predominantly used by law-abiding citizens. You know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of law-abiding citizens use these all the time for lawful purposes. And it's simply not the same scenario where these are somehow being used in crimes. And that's on top of, you know, as you suggest, it actually takes a more concealable handgun and makes it less concealable. And so, again, it's not really even doing what he's purporting that it does.
Then the next one, well, actually, this one was probably first when he started talking about the gun show loophole. I don't know. I've never known there to be one. If you're an FFL dealer, no matter where, and you have an FFL license, no matter where you transact business, anywhere, it doesn't matter what type of facility, right? You have to fill out a form. You have to do the background checks, right?
Right. So what the president gets wrong here, and what a lot of gun control advocates get wrong, whether intentionally or unintentionally, is that background checks are not based on where the gun is being sold, but on who is selling it. And the vast majority of sellers are federal firearms licensees who are in the business of selling firearms for profit. And they have to conduct a background check regardless of where it takes place, including, you know, whether it's at a gun show. The only exception to that is if you are not an FFL, you're just, you know, a random average Joe citizen who wants to sell a couple of your guns, you know, say to get some upgrades on your car, then you don't have to conduct a background check as long as you're selling in person to someone in the same state. But there are still, even then, a lot of other stipulations to that. So if you have reason to believe that someone is a prohibited person, you still can't sell to them. If I believe the language that President Biden used was you can walk away with whatever gun you want. That's still not true. You still can't sell otherwise regulated National Firearms Act weapons, for example, things like short-barreled shotguns, fully automatic machine guns, high caliber, very regulated items. So it's just completely taking the situation and being frankly dishonest about what it is.
I want to try and clear up another myth, and I think I have this correct, but I hear it all the time from gun control activists about FFL dealers have a choice of selling it under their license or themselves privately. And I understand, as I read the law, I understand that not to be true. Do you know?
So I have actually not heard of this being a thing. And I mean, look, at the end of the day, you get people who try to illegally sell guns all the time. We have a very significant black market.
But they're saying there's this loophole in the law. And I don't think there's a loophole in the law. And it comes up with these gun shows. You may not know, I'm a former sheriff. We used to work straw purchase task force with the ATF all the time, and we'd always hear about these folks saying they had these loopholes that the FFL dealers could choose if they had a license to sell under their license or as themselves in an individual capacity, and I don't think they have that right.
No, that is not the way that I would read the law, and I'm sure it's not the way that the federal government would read the law. If you, especially if you're, you know, a singular entity, so you're a person who has become an FFL, there's no way to say, well, now suddenly I, you know, don't want to sell in my personal capacity, or I do want to sell in my personal capacity for these couple limited firearms. And here's the thing, if you're doing that repeatedly and selling in your personal capacity, then you still have to be an FFL. That's the whole purpose.
I thought so. I didn't mean to get on a tangent, but I read your testimony before Congress. Obviously, you do a lot of research in this field. I was very I was moved by your testimony, quite frankly. It was a great job on two other bills that are working their way that are just, I don't know. You know, you said it well when you used the analogy of the operation. It just, these things don't make any sense. So then the president lies for a third time and says that gun manufacturers are exempt from being sued.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I don't know who's writing these things for him, but whoever it is, they need to remove them because they're just misleading the public. That's not the truth, is it?
It is not the truth at all. So the simple reality is you can absolutely sue gun manufacturers, gun sellers at the same level that you could for really any other manufacturer or seller. What you cannot do and what Congress has said you cannot do under a 2005 law is you cannot sue gun manufacturers and sellers who sold guns in complete compliance with the law. You cannot sue them for the criminal actions of the people who ended up buying the guns. And this was a very, very big problem prior to the law. So you would have gun control advocacy groups who would essentially go around knowing that they couldn't otherwise stymie and hamper this lawful business. And what they would do is they would just start, you know, every time someone committed a crime with a gun and they could track it to a gun store or a gun manufacturer, they would just start suing. Even though it was frivolous, it was always getting thrown out. It would essentially cost these lawful businesses millions and millions of dollars, a lot of time, a lot of energy to continually slap down these types of frivolous lawsuits that were accusing them of essentially being criminals for selling lawfully guns in a lawful manner in compliance with the law. So that is the only exemption, and it was for a legitimate reason to keep gun control advocates from kneecapping, essentially, these businesses.
Yeah, and that's not going to be too terribly different from any other type of thing that is sold. So, for example, I could walk into a hardware store, buy a replacement handle for my push broom, go out, take that, and beat someone to death with it. That company would be shielded in the same fashion. They can't get sued for me utilizing their broom handle as a weapon.
Right, and this is, again, it's not unique to gun manufacturers. That's sort of the other misnomer out there. One, if it were unique, it would be entirely warranted given what we were seeing prior to the law. But we also do the same sorts of things in the medicine world. You see some sorts of the same protections actually right now for vaccine manufacturers for COVID, where we are protecting them from future liability for things. So it's just not the case that this is some unique, unwarranted exception where you can't sue gun manufacturers for anything, even if the gun explodes in your hands. And of course, if they're not complying with federal law, if they are knowingly selling to felons, well, then they are potentially liable for criminal penalties as well. So it's just not true.
Yeah. When we come back, Amy, I want to talk about ghost guns because I think our listening audience, a lot of folks probably don't know totally what that is all about. So I'd like to spend a few minutes there. We're talking to Amy Swera, legal fellow at the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation, talking about President Biden's statements yesterday during his press conference in executive action in order to have more provisions relative to gun control and what it will actually do. We'll be right back after the break. Stay with us. So President Biden says yesterday that the Justice Department within 30 days will issue a proposed rule to help stop the proliferation of ghost guns. We are experiencing a growing problem. Criminals are buying kits, coming nearly all of the components and directions for finishing a firearm within as little as 30 minutes and using these firearms to commit crimes. When these firearms turn up at crime scenes, they often cannot be traced by law enforcement due to the lack of a serial number. The Justice Department will issue a proposed rule to help stop the proliferation of these firearms. He said proliferation a number of times. I worked in law enforcement for 40 years. I don't remember a case of a ghost gun. They've been around for several years now, for sure. They're becoming more popular. But is it as easy as he says, 30 minutes to put these things together?
It of course depends on the kit. It depends on sort of what resources you already have available. It is the case that I think these sorts of do-it-yourself kits are probably becoming a bit more common, but they're still not a significant part of the gun crime problem. They're certainly not for mass shootings, where most mass shooters can just buy their guns lawfully. And on top of that, they're very common amongst law-abiding citizens. So this is very common, just like you get people who like to build their own computers and get sort of parts kits or build their own radios. This is a lawful product. And, especially given the history of individual gunsmithing in this country, this is something that goes back a long way of people just being able to, without government control, put together their own firearms. So you just get a lot of legal and practical questions about, how much can you regulate these and to what extent? Because if you start saying, if it takes you 30 minutes or more, again, these are just hunks as they exist when they come in. They're just different parts of carbon fiber and plastic and metal. And at what point do you start, especially if 3D printers become more common, at what point do you start saying, no one can own certain types of carbon fiber materials to put together? It raises far more questions. The enforcement of it is going to be questionable. We go back to what we were talking about earlier. This isn't actually hitting at any of the main problems underlying gun violence.
So what can we expect? He kind of forecasted that maybe they will be required to have a serial number on the frame of the weapon?
Yeah, I mean, that would seem to be what he's going for, at least, not to get too technical in the weeds here, but there's this whole concept of what are known as, 80% receivers, 80% lowers, where they're sort of finished. But again, it takes that 20, 30 minutes at a minimum to sort of finish it off and put it together. Basically, whether he's going to try to get the federal agencies, the DOJ, to say, that in and of itself counts as a firearm, so you have to go through the whole slew of regulation, just like firearms manufacturers, or whether it's going to be more minimal. If you're selling these kits, they all have to be stamped in the same way, but maybe not having to go through all of the process of gun manufacturers as well. I mean, it's hard because we don't have it in front of us. But I think either one of those raises significant constitutional questions, depending on, again, what the rule actually says.
Right. The other thing is that when we focus on serial number and we're focusing, of what we find at a crime scene, is it not true? I mean, the way this ultimately works, you determine whether or not the individual, and sometimes it takes two, possibly 3 days later, you figure out whether or not the individual that actually fired the weapon is the owner or not. In most cases,
right,
that makes little or no difference. In the
right
cases where the gun is stolen, all we can determine is whether or not, we go to that original owner to find out, was your weapon stolen? Yeah, it was stolen about 3 years ago. Did you report it? Yes. maybe no, forgot to, didn't do it. So all that does is show that we knew the previous owner. That's of little or no value, because if we're not able to link the guy to the crime scene and the theft of the weapon, we go nowhere. We actually don't even spend a lot of time trying to do so.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, again, this is the whole thing with serial numbers in general. It is, and this whole idea of essentially contact tracing for firearms, it's really only meaningful after the fact, after the crime has been committed. And we're trying to piece together sort of where did it come from? Has this been used in other crimes necessarily? And so what the ATF can do is basically go back and see where was this gun sold from initially. Right. But again, given that you can lend and transfer and steal guns and you know, sell them on arms list, or you know, lose them mysteriously and then they end up in the black market, you know, there are plenty of ways that it's still almost impossible to track down who committed that crime with that gun. So it's, you know, it just, again, is not, I think, the most efficient way of dealing with the problem of gun crime in this country.
The president also says that within 60 days, the Justice Department will publish model red flag legislation for states. What's interesting about this, and I don't know why anyone thinks that this is earth-shattering, I have to imagine by now most states have already engaged in some contemplation of whether or not they're willing, their legislative bodies are willing to adopt these provisions.
Right. You know, and you know, that is sort of the difference between what the executive branch can do and what Congress can do. So what you tend to see with Congress is, you know, if Congress were to pass some sort of model red flag legislation, they can sort of incentivize states by tying it to funding for other things. The executive branch can't necessarily do that, especially not to the same extent. So when you look at what he has asked the Department of Justice to do, it's sort of to just say, well, you know, here are some suggestions for a model red flag law, and it's not tied to any incentive or disincentive or anything like that, which in and of itself, I mean, again, we don't have this sort of model red flag law from the DOJ yet, but if it's anything like what we've seen in states that have already been willing to pass them, is a good chance it's going to raise a lot of significant due process concerns and other sorts of concerns about the underlying motives and how it can be abused. You know, so we have to wait to see that text, but, you know, there are some legitimate concerns about how this has been done.
And the, you know, the sharing of this information as to who actually has been diagnosed with some type of mental incapacity is, you know, an environment in this country that has yet to really work itself out. There's a lot of uneasiness, I guess is a good way of saying it, on all sides of the aisle as to how much information can be shared. And there's also, I'm sure, Amy, you're aware of all kinds of federal statutes that prohibit the sharing of this information.
Right. And so, you know, these are concerns that come up, especially because, you know, theoretically with red flag laws, the whole point is to sort of to target individuals who haven't, you know, yet reached a level where they can necessarily be involuntarily committed to treatment. But they're clearly sort of reaching that level. You know, so then you run into this whole other host of problems, which is, you know, you don't want to tag people with lifelong mental health disabilities for something that is supposed to be for temporary intervention, where we're not quite sure that they've reached that, you know, that legal level that already exists. So it's, you know, it really is. It's complicated and balancing a lot of factors that we already have to balance in the mental health policy world. You know, not wanting to stigmatize people, not wanting to prevent them from seeking necessary help because they feel like if they do, that gun control advocates and politicians will use it as an excuse to just start stripping gun rights from them that they'll never get back. So we don't want to punish people for doing the right thing, but we also, you know, want to ensure that people who are clearly, and I mean very clearly, like what we saw with this individual in Boulder, Colorado, you know, who are very clearly suffering from some pretty profound mental health problems, you know, and being able to direct them in a more official way towards getting help.
Yeah. And then the Biden administration says, I don't mean to sound cynical, but as long as I've been around, no worry. You know, there's been a historic spike in homicides, and therefore the Biden-Harris administration has taken a number of steps to prioritize investment in community violence interventions. So we're going to throw $5 billion at this over 8 years to support community violence intervention programs to try and deal with drug crimes. Now, this one drives me crazy because at the same time we're electing progressive DAs across this country who are actually refusing to prosecute gun crimes.
And, right.
I mean, we have so many laws in and around gun crimes. If we maybe took $5 billion and created gun crime task forces, we might reduce, you know, or have a better shot at reducing gun crimes and the violence right. that goes along with it than prioritizing a jobs plan in these historically violent neighborhoods across the country.
Right. Well, so there's sort of two sides to the same coin here, because these things go together. So on the one hand, we do know that, you know, violence is a very complicated issue, but we do know that there are some factors that are fairly heavily related to it. So this, you know, anti-gang violence prevention programs, you know, that focus on education and basically you know, turning these into healthy communities, whether it's education, job opportunities, healthy families, whatever it might be, those are actually good things that do help entire communities, especially those ravaged by gun crime, drug crime, et cetera. But on the other hand, when you look at what has actually caused this sort of this massive spike in 2020 in a lot of these places, it's actually almost directly related to changing police and prosecution practices, and not to changes in, you know, education programs or pro-family programs or anything like that. So you need both. You need the side of it that is engaged in helping and revitalizing communities, but then you also need the side of it that says, no, actually, we are serious about having a police presence in punishing people who are breaking the law and ravaging these communities with crime. So it's both and I think you're right in suggesting that if you only have the one side of it, it's not going to do nearly as much good.
Yeah, and what really struck me is that he's ordering five federal agencies. He says that at the present time they are making changes to 26 different programs that direct vital support to community violence intervention programs. I've seen this before. These dollars are being moved from enforcement to these other programs. And because I've worked on just about every federal task force there is to work on, whether it be with the FBI, ATF, DEA, immigration or otherwise, anytime these programs go away, the dollars are being redirected for some more social type program in these violent neighborhoods.
Yeah, and so, you know, that does seem to be the case. Again, I don't know how much of that is true, you know, given these executive orders, and part of that is because we don't have the text. I know actually the funding, a lot of it was related to the infrastructure bills that occurred last week. You know, so you are right, though. A lot of this has to do with how it is put into practice.
Yeah, I think the most interesting thing is yet to reveal itself as to the words they put on the paper. At one point, words matter. I'm not so sure anymore, but it's, you know, I can't help but chuckle as to see what these proposals are actually going to be. We've been down this road before, right? You would think that these pro gun control folks would have realized that this is nothing new. You know, the words in the order may have been changed, and you know, as Shakespeare said, is a rose by any other name. You can try and change the names of this stuff, but it's the same gobbledygook, is it not?
Yes, to an extent. But, you know, again, I do want to wait and see sort of what comes out in the order. So, you know, even then, there's only so much that these orders as executive orders can accomplish, regardless of the wording.
So of everything he announced yesterday, I think the thing that as a gun advocate, that I would be the most concerned with is his nomination of David Chipman.
And absolutely,
you know, to serve as a director of the Bureau of the ATF, not the AFT, as the president referred to yesterday. But not to get picayunish, but the fact of the matter is that this guy, we know squarely where his beliefs are.
Yes, we absolutely do. You know, and, you know, for context, I mean, could you imagine the outrage if President Trump had nominated a director of the ATF who had been an NRA lobbyist, not just, you know, part of the NRA, but an actual NRA lobbyist, you know, lobbying against gun control? A lot of people on the left would have lost their minds. And this is really the equivalent that we have here. This is an individual who is a career ATF agent involved in, you know, some of the more questionable aspects of the ATF, with Waco, for example. I believe he had some involvement there. But even on top of that, I mean, you look at just what he has said in the last several years. He is he's one of those individuals that he's not just ill-informed, you know, or he knows better. So, for example, sure. He sat next to me when I testified in front of the House Judiciary Committee, and I very clearly remember him telling the House that barrel shrouds, the primary purpose of barrel shrouds, that it enables people to shoot rapidly from the hip, which thereby facilitates mass shootings because they can shoot from the hip, which is absurd for so many levels. And he knows this. First of all, that's not the purpose of a barrel shroud. Second of all, I'm not aware of any mass shooter who has ever attempted to shoot from the hip. Frankly, I wish they would shoot from the hip. It's less accurate that way, you know, and it doesn't change rapidity. So that's the sort of thing that he has been, you know, out there saying to people.
Yeah, crazy for sure. Amy Swera, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate your time, your insight. I enjoyed reading your testimony as well. Keep up the great work. We really appreciate it. And have a great weekend.
Thank you. You as well.
All righty, folks, we'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers talk and text line. Give us a shout. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.